central canal that ran up the center of the district and made their way down the silent quay, keeping close to the warehouses and away from the street lamps that lined the water's edge. They passed barges loaded with lumber and vast troughs piled high with coal. Every so often they'd glimpse men working by lantern light, hefting barrels of rum or bales of cotton. Such valued cargo could not be left unattended overnight. When they had almost reached Sweet Reef, they saw two men unloading something from a large wagon, parked by the side of the canal, lit by a single blue-tinged lamp. "Corpse light," whispered Inej, and Nina shuddered. Bone lights, made from the crushed skeletons of deep-sea fishes, glowed green. But the corpse lights burned some other fuel, a blue warning that allowed people to identify the flatboats of the body men, whose cargo was the dead. "What are the body men doing in the warehouse district?" "People don't like to see corpses on the streets or canals. The warehouse district is nearly deserted at night. So this is where they bring the bodies. Once the sun goes down, the body men collect the dead and bring them here. They work in shifts, neighborhood by neighborhood. They'll be gone by dawn, and so will their cargo. Out to the Reaper's barge for burning."
"Why don't they just build a real cemetery?"
Nina said.
"No room. I know there was some talk of reopening Black Vale a long time ago, but that all stopped when the Queen's Lady Plague struck. People are too afraid of contagion. If your family can afford it, they send you to a cemetery or a graveyard outside Ketterdam. And if they can't..."
"No mourners," Nina said grimly. "No mourners, no funerals. Another way of saying good luck, but it was something more. A dark wink to the fact that there would be no expensive burials for people like them. No marble markers to remember their names. No wreaths of myrtle and rose." Inej took the lead as they approached Sweet Reef. The silos themselves were daunting, vast as sentinel gods. Monuments to industry emblazoned with the Vanek red laurel. Soon everyone would know what that emblem stood for. Cowardice and deceit. The circular cluster of Vanek's silos was surrounded by a high metal fence.
"Razor wire,"
Nina noted.
"It won't be a problem."
It had been invented to keep livestock in their pens. It would present no challenge for the Wraith. They took up a watch beside the sturdy red brick wall of a warehouse and held their position, confirming that the guards' routine hadn't changed. Just as Kaz had said, the guards took almost 12 minutes exactly to circle the fence that surrounded the silos. When the patrols were on the eastern side of the perimeter, Inej would have roughly 6 minutes to cross the wire. Once they passed to the west side, it would be too easy for them to spot her on the wire between the silos. But she'd be almost impossible to see on the roof. During those 6 minutes, Inej would deal with depositing the weevil in the silo hatch and then detach the line. If it took her longer than 6 minutes, she'd simply have to wait for the guards to come back around. She'd be unable to see them, but Nina had a powerful bone light in hand. She would signal Inej with a brief flash of green when she was clear to make the crossing.
10 silos, Inej said. 9 crossings.
They're a lot taller up close, said Nina. Are you ready for this?
Inej couldn't deny they were intimidating.
No matter the height of the mountain, the climbing is the same.
That's not technically true. You need ropes, picks.
Don't be a Matthias.
Nina covered her mouth in horror.
I'm going to eat twice as much cake to make up for it.
Inej nodded wisely.
Sound policy.
The patrol was setting out from the guardhouse again.
Inej,
Nina said haltingly.
You should know. My power hasn't been the same since the Parem.
If we get into a scuffle... No scuffles tonight. We pass through like ghosts.
She gave Nina's shoulders a squeeze.
And I know no fiercer warrior. Powers or not.
But...
Nina, the guards.
The patrol had disappeared from view. If they didn't act now, they would have to wait for the next cycle. And it would put them behind schedule.
On it,
Nina said, and strode toward the guardhouse. In the few steps it took her to cross the space from their warehouse lookout to the pool of lamplight bathing the guardhouse, Nina's whole demeanor changed. Inej couldn't quite explain it, but her steps grew more tentative, her shoulders drooped slightly. She almost seemed to shrink. She was no longer a trained Grisha, but a young, nervous immigrant hoping for a shred of kindness.
"Please, to excuse,"
Nina said in a ridiculously thick Ravkin accent. The guard held his weapon at the ready but didn't look particularly concerned.
"You shouldn't be here at night."
Nina murmured something, looking up at him with big green eyes. Inish had no idea she could look so thoroughly wholesome.
"What was that?"
said the guard, stepping closer. Inej made her move. She lit the long fuse on the low-grade flash bomb Wyland had given them, then loped for the fence, keeping well away from that pool of light, climbing silently. She was almost directly behind the guard and Nina, then above them. She could hear their voices as she slipped easily between the coils of razor wire.
"I come for job, yes?"
Nina said.
"To make sugar."
"We don't make it here, just store it. You'll want to go to one of the processing plants."
"But I need a job. I...
"Oh, hey now, don't cry. There, there."
Inej restrained a snort and dropped soundlessly to the ground on the other side of the fence. Through it, she could see the sandbags Kaz had mentioned stacked against the back wall of the guardhouse and the corner of what must be the net he'd planned for her to use.
Your fellow looking for work, too?"
the guard was asking.
"I have no... how you say? Fella?"
The gate beside the guardhouse didn't lock from the inside, so Inej pushed it open, leaving it just barely ajar for Nina, and hurried to the shadows at the base of the nearest silo. She heard Nina say her goodbyes and walk off in the direction opposite their lookout. Then Inej waited. The minutes passed, and just as she became convinced the bomb was defective, a loud pop sounded, and a bright flash of light crackled from the warehouse they'd used to spy on the guards. The guard emerged again, rifle raised, and took a few paces toward the warehouse.
"Hello?"
he shouted. Nina slipped from the shadows behind him and was inside the gate in a matter of moments. She closed it securely and headed for the second silo, disappearing into the dark. From there, she would be able to signal Inej as the guards made their rounds. The guard returned to his post, walking backward in case some threat still waited in the warehouses beyond. Finally, he turned and gave the gate a shake to make sure it was locked, then headed inside the guardhouse. Inej waited for the signal from Nina, then scampered up the rungs welded to the side of the silo. One story. Two stories. 10. At the carnival, her uncle would have kept the audience entertained during her ascent.
"No trick like this has ever been attempted before, and certainly never by one so young. Above you, behold the terrifying high wire."
A spotlight would come on, lighting the wire so that it looked like the frailest skein of cobweb strung across the tent.
"Gentlemen, take your lady's hand in yours. See how slender her fingers are. Now imagine, if you will, trying to walk across something so slender, so fragile as that. Who would dare such a thing? Who would dare to defy death itself?"
Then Inej would stand at the top of the pole and, hands on hips, shout, "I will," and the crowd would gasp.
"But wait, no, this can't be right," her uncle would say. "A little girl?"
At this point, the crowd would always go wild. Women would swoon. Sometimes one of the men would try to stop the show. There was no crowd tonight, only the wind, the cold metal beneath her fingers, the bright face of the moon. Inej reached the top of the silo and looked out over the city below. Kedar Dam gleamed with golden light, lanterns moving slowly across the canals, candles left burning in windows, shops and taverns still shining bright for the evening's business. She could make out the glittering spangle of the lid, the colorful lanterns and showy cascade bulbs of the staves. In just a few short days, Vanek's fortunes would be ruined, and she would be free of her contract with Per Haskell. Free to live as she wished, to seek forgiveness for her sins, to pursue her purpose. Would she miss this place, this crowded mess of a city she'd come to know so well that had somehow become her home? She felt certain she would. So tonight she would perform for her city, for the citizens of Kedar Dam, even if they did not know to applaud. Though it took a bit of muscle, she managed to loosen the wheel of the silo hatch and wrench it open. She reached into her pocket and took out the capped vial of the chemical weevil. Following Weiland's instructions, she gave it a firm shake, then spilled the contents into the silo. A low hiss filled the air, and as she watched, the sugar moved as if something was alive beneath its surface. She shivered. She'd heard of workers dying in silos, getting caught inside when the grain or corn or sugar gave way beneath their feet, being slowly suffocated to death. She closed the hatch and sealed it tight. Then she reached down to the first rung of the metal ladder and attached the magnetized clamp Weiland had given her. It certainly felt like a solid grip. With the press of a button, two magnetized guide wires sprang free and attached to the silo with a soft clang. She removed a crossbow and a heavy coil of wire from her pack, then looped one end of the wire through the clamp, secured it tightly, and attached the guide wires. The other end was fastened to a magnetized clamp loaded into the crossbow. She released the trigger. The first shot went astray, and she had to wind the wire back. The second shot hooked to the wrong rung, but the third shot latched properly in place on the next silo. She twisted the clamp until the tension in the line felt right. They'd used similar gear before, but never on a distance so wide, or a climb so high. It didn't matter. The distance, the danger, would be transformed upon the wire, and she would be transformed too. On the high wire, she was beholden to no one, a creature without past or present, suspended between earth and sky. It was time. You could learn the swings, but you had to be born to the wire. Inez's mother had told her that gifted wirewalkers were descended from the people of the air, that they'd once had wings, and that in the right light those wings could still be glimpsed on the humans to whom they showed favor. After that, Inez was perpetually twisting this way and that in front of mirrors and checking her shadow, ignoring the laughter of her cousins, to see if perhaps her own wings might be showing. When her father grew tired of her pestering him every day, he allowed her to begin her education on the low ropes, barefoot, so that she could get a feel for walking forward and backward, keeping her center balanced. She'd been bored senseless, but she'd dutifully gone through the exercises each day, testing her strength, trying the feel of leather shoes that would allow her to grip the stiffer, less friendly wire. If her father got distracted, she would flip into a handstand, so that when he turned back to her, she was traversing the rope on her hands. He agreed to raise the rope a few inches, let her try a proper wire. And at each level, Inez mastered one skill after another, cartwheels, flips, keeping a pitcher of water perched on her head. She familiarized herself with the slender, flexible pole that would allow her to keep her balance at greater heights. One afternoon, her uncle and cousins had been setting up a new act. Hansi was going to push Asha across the wire in a wheelbarrow. The day was hot, and they decided to take a break for lunch and go for a swim in the river. Alone in the quiet camp, Inez scaled one of the platform rigs they'd erected, making sure her back was to the sun so that she'd have a clear view of the wire. That high up, the world became a reflection of itself, its shapes stunted, its shadows elongated, familiar in its forms but somehow untrustworthy. And as Inez placed her slippered foot on the wire, she'd felt a sudden moment of doubt. Though this was the same width of wire she'd walked for weeks without fear, it seemed far thinner now, as if in this mirror world the wire obeyed different rules. When fear arrives, something is about to happen. Inez breathed deeply, tucked her hips beneath her navel, and took her first steps on the air. Beneath her, the grass was an undulating sea. She felt her weight shift, listed left, felt the pull of the earth, gravity ready to unite her with her shadow far below. Her muscles flexed. She bent her knees. The moment passed, and then there was only her and the wire. She was already halfway across when she realized she was being watched. She let her vision expand, but kept her focus. Inez would never forget the look on her father's face as he returned from the river with her uncle and cousins, his head tilted up at her, mouth a startled black O. Her mother emerging from the wagon and pressing a hand over her heart. They had stayed silent, afraid to break her concentration. Her first audience on the wire, mute with terror that felt to her like adulation. Once she'd climbed down, her mother had spent the better part of an hour alternating between hugging her and shrieking at her. Her father had been stern, but she hadn't missed the pride in his gaze or the grudging admiration in her cousin's eyes. When one of them had taken her aside later and said, "How do you walk so fearlessly?" she'd simply shrugged and said, "It's just walking." But that wasn't true. It was better than walking. When others walked the wire, they fought it. The wind, the height, the distance. When Inej was on the high wire, it became her world. She could feel its tilt and pull. It was a planet, and she was its moon. There was a simplicity to it that she never felt on the swings, where she was carried away by momentum. She loved the stillness she could find on the wire, and it was something no one else understood. She had fallen only once, and she still blamed it on the net. They'd strung it up because Hanzi was adding a unicycle to his act. One moment Inej was walking, and the next she was falling. She barely had time to register it before she hit the net and bounced right out of it onto the ground. Inej felt somewhat startled to discover how very hard the earth was, that it would not soften or bend for her. She broke two ribs and had a lump on her head the size of a fat goose egg.
"It's good that it's so large," her father murmured over it. "That means the blood is not inside her brain."
As soon as Inej's bandages came off, she was back on the wire. She never worked with a net again. She knew it had made her careless. But, looking down now, she could admit she wouldn't have minded a little insurance. Far below, the moonlight caught the curves of the cobblestones, making them look like the black seeds of some exotic fruit. But the net stashed behind the guardhouse was useless, with only Nina there to hold it, and regardless of what Kaz had originally intended, the new plan hadn't been built around someone in plain sight holding a net. So, Inej would walk, as she had always done, with nothing to catch her, borne aloft by her invisible wings. Inej slid the balance pole from its loop on her vest and, with a flick, extended it to its full length. She tested its weight in her hands, flexed her toes in her slippers. They were leather, stolen from the Circus Zirkoa at her request. Their smooth soles lacked the firm, tactile grip of her beloved rubber shoes, but the slippers allowed her to release more easily. At last, the signal came from Nina. A brief flash of green light. Inej stepped out onto the wire. Instantly, the wind snatched at her, and she released a long breath, feeling its persistent tug, using the flexible pole to pull her center of gravity lower. She let her knees bounce once. Thankfully, the wire had almost no give. She walked, feeling the hard press of it beneath the arches of her feet. With each step, it bowed slightly, eager to twist away from her gripping toes. The air felt warm against her skin. It smelled of sugar and molasses. Her hood was down, and she could feel the hairs from her braid escaping to tickle her face. She focused on the wire, feeling the familiar kinship she'd experienced as a child, as if the wire were clinging to her as closely as she clung to it, welcoming her into that mirror world, a secret place occupied by her alone. In moments, she'd reached the rooftop of the second silo. She stepped onto it, retracting the balance pole and returning it to its sling. She took a sip of water from the flask in her pocket, allowed herself the briefest moment to stretch. Then she opened the hatch and dropped in the weevil. Again she heard that crackling hiss and her nose filled with the smell of burning sugar. It was stronger this time, a sweet, dense cloud of perfume. Suddenly she was back at the menagerie, a thick hand grasping her wrist, demanding. Inej had gotten good at anticipating when a memory might seize her, bracing for it. But this time she wasn't prepared. It came at her, more insistent than the wind on the wire, sending her mind sprawling. Though he smelled of vanilla, beneath it she could smell garlic. She felt the slither of silk all around her as if the bed itself were a living thing. Inej didn't remember all of them. As the nights at the menagerie had strung together, she had become better at numbing herself, vanishing so completely that she almost didn't care what was done to the body she left behind. She learned that the men who came to the house never looked too closely, never asked too many questions. They wanted an illusion, and they were willing to ignore anything to preserve that illusion. Tears, of course, were forbidden. She had cried the first night, Tanta Helene had used the switch on her, then the cane, then choked her until she'd passed out. The next time, Inej's fear was greater than her sorrow. She learned to smile, to whisper, to arch her back and make the sounds Tanta Helene's customers required. She still wept, but the tears were never shed. They filled the empty place inside her, a well of sadness where each night she sank like a stone. The menagerie was one of the most expensive pleasure houses in the barrel, but its customers were no kinder than those who frequented the dollar houses and alley girls. In some ways, Inej came to understand. They were worse.
"When a man spends that much coin," said the Kalish girl, Kyra, "he thinks he's earned the right to do whatever he wants."
There were young men, old men, handsome men, ugly men. There was the man who cried and struck her when he could not perform. The man who wanted her to pretend it was their wedding night and tell him that she loved him. The man with sharp teeth like a kitten who had bitten at her breasts until she'd bled. Tanta Helene added the price of the blood-speckled sheets and the days of work Inej missed to her indenture. But he hadn't been the worst. The worst had been a Rothkin man who had chosen her in the parlor, the man who smelled of vanilla, only when they were back in her room amid the purple silks and incense. Did he say, "I've seen you before, you know." Inej had laughed, thinking this was part of the game he wished to play, and poured him wine from a golden carafe.
Surely not.
It was years ago, at one of the carnivals outside Karjeva. Wine sloshed over the lip of the glass.
"You must have me confused with someone else."
"No," he said, eager as a boy. "I'm sure of it. I saw your family perform there. I was on military leave. You couldn't have been more than 10. The barest slip of a girl walking the high wire without fear. You wore a headdress covered in roses. At one point, you bobbled. You lost your footing and the petals of your crown came loose in a cloud that drifted down, down."
He fluttered his fingers through the air, as if miming a snowfall.
"The crowds gasped, and so did I. I came back the second night, and it happened again. And even though then I knew it was all part of the act, I still felt my heart clench as you pretended to regain your balance."
Inej tried to steady her shaking hands. The rose headdress had been her mother's idea.
"You make it look too easy, Meja, scampering around like a squirrel on a branch. They must believe you are in danger, even if you are not."
That had been Inej's worst night at the menagerie, because when the man who smelled of vanilla had begun to kiss her neck and peel away her silks, she hadn't been able to leave her body behind. Somehow his memory of her had tied her past and present together, pinned her there beneath him. She'd cried, but he hadn't seemed to mind. Inej could hear the hissing of the sugar as the weevil did its work. She forced herself to focus on the sound, to breathe past the constriction in her throat.
"I will have you without armor."
Those were the words she'd said to Kaz aboard the Feralind, desperate for some sign that he might open himself to her, that they could be more than two wary creatures united by their distrust of the world. But what might have happened if he'd spoken that night? If he had willingly offered her some part of his heart? What if he had come to her, laid his gloves aside, drawn her to him, kissed her mouth? Would she have pulled him closer, kissed him back? Could she have been herself in such a moment, or would she have broken apart and vanished? A doll in his arms, a girl who could never quite be whole. It didn't matter. Kaz hadn't spoken. And perhaps that had been best for them both. They could continue on with their armor intact. She would have her ship, and he would have his city. Inej reached out to close the hatch, and took a deep breath of coal-tinged air, coughing the sweetness of the ruined sugar from her lungs. Then she stumbled, as she felt a hand grab the back of her neck, shove her forward. She felt her center of gravity shift as she was sucked into the yawning mouth of the silo.
18. Kaz. Getting into the house wasn't nearly as difficult as it should have been, and it put Kaz on edge. Was he giving Van Eck too much credit? The man thinks like a merch, Kaz reminded himself, as he tucked his cane beneath his arm and eased down a drainpipe. He still believes his money keeps him safe. The easiest points of entry were the windows on the house's top floor, accessible only from the roof. Weiland wasn't up to the climb or the descent, so Kaz would go first and get him inside via the lower floors. Two good legs and he still needs a ladder, Kaz muttered, ignoring the twinge his leg gave in agreement. He wasn't thrilled to be on another job with Weiland, but Weiland's knowledge of the house and his father's habits would be useful if any surprises cropped up, and he was best equipped to handle the auric acid. Kaz thought of Inej, perched on the roof of the Church of Barter, the city lights glinting below. This is what I'm good at, so let me do my job. Fine, he would let them all do their jobs. Nina would hold up her end of the mission, and Inej had seemed confident enough in her ability to walk the wire, with little rest and without the security of a net. Would she have told you if she was afraid? Is that something you've ever shown sympathy for? Kaz shook the thought from his mind. If Inej didn't doubt her abilities, then he shouldn't either. Besides, if they wanted that seal for Nina's darling refugees, he had his own problems to contend with. Luckily, Van Eck's security system wasn't one of them. Inej's surveillance had indicated that the locks were Skylar work. They were complicated bastards, but once you'd cracked one, you'd cracked them all. Kaz had gotten on very friendly terms with a locksmith in Kluckstrat, who firmly believed Kaz was the son of a wealthy merchant who highly valued his collection of priceless snuff boxes. Consequently, Kaz was always first to know exactly how the rich of Ketterdam were keeping their property secure. Kaz had once heard Hubrecht Morin, master thief of Peel, extemporizing on the beauty of a quality lock while drunk on brown lager in the Crow Club.
A lock is like a woman, he'd said blearily. You have to seduce it into giving up its secrets.
He was one of Per Haskell's old cronies, happy to talk about better days and big scams, especially if it meant he didn't have to do much work. And that was exactly the kind of muddled wisdom these old cadgers loved to spout. Sure, a lock was like a woman. It was also like a man, and anyone or anything else. If you wanted to understand it, you had to take it apart and see how it worked. If you wanted to master it, you had to learn it so well you could put it back together. The lock on the window gave way in his hands with a satisfying click. He slid open the sash and climbed inside. The tiny rooms on the top floor of Van Eck's house were devoted to the servants' quarters, but all of the staff were currently occupied below with Van Eck's guests. Some of the richest members of the Kirch Merchant Council were filling their bellies in the first floor dining room, probably listening to Van Eck's tale of woe about his son's kidnapping, and commiserating about the gangs controlling the barrel. From the smell in the air, Kaz suspected ham was on the menu. He opened the door and quietly made his way to the staircase, then proceeded cautiously down to the second floor. He knew Van Eck's house from when he and Inej had heisted the decapel oil, and he always liked returning to a home or a business he'd had cause to visit before. It wasn't just the familiarity. It was as if by returning, he laid claim to a place. We know each other's secrets, the house seemed to say. Welcome back. A guard stood at attention at the end of the carpeted hallway in front of what Kaz knew was Alice's door. Kaz checked his watch. There was a brief pop and a flash of light from the window at the end of the hall. At least Weiland was punctual. The guard went to investigate, and Kaz slipped down the hall in the other direction. He ducked into Weiland's old room, which was now clearly intended to be the nursery. By the light from the street below, he could see its walls had been decorated with an elaborate seascape mural. The bassinet was shaped like a tiny sailing ship, complete with flags and a captain's wheel. Van Eck was really embracing this new air thing. Kaz worked the lock on the nursery window and pushed it open, then secured the rope ladder and waited. He heard a loud thud and winced. Apparently Weiland had made it over the garden wall. Hopefully he hadn't broken the containers of auric acid and burned a hole through himself and the rose bushes. A moment later, Kaz heard panting
and Weiland rounded the corner, bustling along like a harried goose. When he was below the window, he tucked his satchel carefully against his body and climbed up the rope ladder, sending it swaying wildly left and right. Kaz helped him through the window, then pulled the ladder in and closed the sash. They'd exit the same way. Weiland looked around the nursery with wide eyes, then just shook his head. Kaz checked the hall. The guard was back at his post in front of Alice's door. "Well?" Kaz whispered to Weiland.
"It's a slow-burning fuse," said Weiland. "The timing is imprecise."
The seconds ticked by. Finally, another pop sounded. The guard returned to the window, and Kaz gestured for Weiland to follow him along the hallway. Kaz made quick work on the lock on Van Eck's office door, and they were inside in moments. When Kaz had broken into the house to steal the decapel, he'd been surprised by the office's plush trappings. He'd expected severe mercher restraint, but the woodwork was heavily ornamented with swags of laurel leaves, and a chair the size of a throne, upholstered in crimson velvet, loomed over the wide, glossy desk.
"Behind the painting," Weiland whispered,
gesturing to a portrait of one of the Van Eck ancestors.
"Which member of your hallowed line is that supposed to be?"
"Martin Van Eck, my great-great-grandfather. He was a ship's captain, the first to land at Ames Chin and navigate the river inland. He brought back a shipload of spices and used the profits to buy a second ship. That's what my father told me anyway. That was the start of the Van Eck fortune.
And will be the end of it."
Kaz shook out a bone light, and the green glow filled the room.
"Quite a resemblance," he said, glancing at the gaunt face, the high brow, and stern blue eyes.
Weiland shrugged. "Except for the red hair I always took after my father. And his father and all the Van Ecks. Well, until now." They each took a side of the painting and lifted it from the wall.
"Look at you,"
Kaz crooned as Van Eck's safe came into view. Safe didn't even seem like the right word. It was more like a vault, a steel door set into a wall that had been itself reinforced with more steel. The lock on it was Kirchmade, but nothing like Kaz had ever seen before. A series of tumblers that could be reset with a random combination of numbers every day. Impossible to crack in less than an hour. But if you couldn't open a door, you just had to make a new one. The sound of raised voices filtered up from the floor below. The merchers were finding something to disagree about. Kaz wouldn't have minded a chance to eavesdrop on that conversation.
"Let's go," he said. "The clock is ticking."
Weiland removed two jars from his satchel. On their own, they were nothing special. But if Weiland was right, once they were combined, the resulting compound would burn through everything except the balsa glass container. Weiland took a deep breath and held the jars away from his body.
"Stay back," he said,
and poured the contents of one jar into the other. Nothing happened.
"Well?" Kaz said. "Move, please."
Weiland took a balsa glass pipette and drew out a small amount of liquid, letting it trickle down the front of the safe's steel door. Instantly, the metal began to dissolve, giving off a noisy crackle that seemed uncomfortably loud in the small room. A sharp metallic smell filled the air, and both Kaz and Weiland covered their faces with their sleeves.
"Trouble in a bottle," Kaz marveled.
Weiland worked steadily, carefully transferring the auric acid from the jar onto the steel, the hole in the safe door growing steadily larger.
"Pick up the pace," Kaz said, eyeing his watch. "If I spill a single drop of this, it will burn straight through the floor onto my father's dinner guests."
"Take your time."
The acid consumed the metal in rapid bursts, burning quickly and only gradually tapering off. Hopefully it wouldn't eat through too much of the wall after they left. He didn't mind the idea of the office collapsing on Van Eck and his guests, but not before the night's business was complete. After what felt like a lifetime, the hole was big enough to reach through. Kaz shone the bone light inside and saw a ledger, stacks of Kruga, and a little velvet bag. Kaz drew the bag from the safe, wincing when his arm made contact with the edge of the hole. The steel was still hot enough to singe. He shook the contents of the bag into his leather-clad palm. A fat gold ring with an engraving of a red laurel and Van Eck's initials.
He tucked the ring into his pocket, then grabbed a couple of stacks of Truga and handed one over to Wylan. Kaz almost laughed at the expression on Wylan's face. Does this bother you, Merchling? I don't enjoy feeling like a thief. After everything he's done? Yes. So much for righteous. You do realize we're stealing your money. Jesper said the same thing, but I'm sure my father wrote me out of his will as soon as Alice became pregnant. That doesn't mean you're any less entitled to it. I don't want it. I just don't want him to have it. What a luxury to turn your back on luxury. Kaz shoved the Kruger into his pockets. How would I run an empire? Wylan said, tossing the pipette into the safe to smolder. I can't read a ledger or a bill of lading. I can't write a purchase order. My father is wrong about a lot of things, but he's right about that. I'd be a laughingstock. So pay someone to do that work for you. Would you? Asked Wylan, his chin jutting forward. Trust someone with that knowledge? With a secret that could destroy you? Yes, thought Kaz without hesitation. There's one person I would trust. One person I know would never use my weaknesses against me. He thumbed quickly through the ledger and said, When people see a cripple walking down the street leaning on his cane, what do they feel? Wylan looked away. People always did when Kaz talked about his limp, as if he didn't know what he was or how the world saw him. They feel pity. Now, what do they think when they see me coming? Wylan's mouth quirked up at the corner. They think they'd better cross the street. Kaz tossed the ledger back in the safe. You're not weak because you can't read. You're weak because you're afraid of people seeing your weakness. You're letting shame decide who you are. Help me with the painting. They lifted the portrait back into place over the gaping hole in the safe. Martin Van Eck glared down at them. Think on it, Wylan, Kaz said as he straightened the frame. It's shame that lines my pockets. Shame that keeps the barrel teeming with fools ready to put on a mask just so they can have what they want with no one the wiser for it. We can endure all kinds of pain. It's shame that eats men whole. Wise words, said a voice from the corner. Kaz and Wylan whirled. The lamps flared brightly, flooding the room with light, and a figure emerged from a niche in the opposite wall that hadn't been there a moment before. Pekka Rollins, a smug grin on his ruddy face, bracketed by a cluster of dime lions all carrying pistols, saps, and axe handles. Kaz Brekker, Rollins mocked. Philosopher Crook.
19. Matthias.
Stay down!
Matthias shouted at Kuwe. The shoeboy flattened himself to the floor. A second rattle of gunfire shook the air, shattering another of the stained glass portals.
Either they're interested in wasting a lot of bullets or those are warning shots, said Jesper.
In a low crouch, Matthias edged to the other side of the tomb and peered through a thin crack in the stone.
We're surrounded, he said.
The people standing between Black Veil's graves were a far cry from the Stadtwatch officers he'd expected to see. In the flickering light of lanterns and torches, Matthias glimpsed plaid and paisley striped vests and checkered coats. The uniform of the barrel. They carried equally motley weapons, guns, knives as long as a man's forearm, wooden bats.
I can't make out their tattoos, said Jesper. But I'm pretty sure that's Doughty up front.
Doughty. Matthias searched his memory, then remembered the man who escorted them to Pekka Rollins when Kaz had sought a loan. Dime Lions.
A lot of them. What do they want?
Said Kuwe tremulously. Matthias could hear people laughing, shouting, and beneath it all, the low, fevered buzz that came when soldiers knew they had the advantage, when they scented the promise of bloodshed in the air. A cheer arose from the crowd as a dime lion sprinted forward and hurled something toward the tomb. It soared through one of the broken windows and hit the floor with a clang. Green gas burst from its sides. Matthias yanked a horse blanket from the floor and threw it over the canister. He shoved it back through the porthole as another stutter of gunfire split the air. His eyes burned, tears streaming down his cheeks. Now the buzz was cresting. The dime lions surged forward. Jesper squeezed off a shot and one of the advancing crew fell, his torch extinguished on the damp ground. Again and again Jesper fired, his aim unerring as Dime Lions toppled. Their ranks broke as they scattered for cover.
"Keep lining them up, boys," Jesper said grimly.
"Come on out!"
bellowed Doughty from behind a grave.
"You can't shoot us all!"
"I can't hear you!" shouted Jesper. "Come closer!"
"We smashed your boats. You got no way off this island except us. So come quiet, or we'll just bring your heads back to the barrel."
"Watch out!" said Matthias.
Doughty had been distracting them. Another canister crashed through a window, then another.
"The catacomb!"
Matthias roared, and they raced for the opposite end of the tomb, cramming themselves into the passage and sealing the stone door behind them. Jesper tore off his shirt and shoved it into the gap between the door and the floor. The dark was almost complete. For a moment, there was only the sound of the three of them coughing and gasping, trying to dislodge the gas from their lungs. Then Jesper shook out a bone light, and their faces were lit by an eerie green glow.
"How the hell did they find us?" he asked.
"It doesn't matter," said Matthias. There was no time to think about how Black Veil had been compromised. All he knew was that if Pekka Rollins had sent his gang after them, Nina might be in danger too.
"What are our assets?"
"Weiland left us with a bunch of those violet bombs in case we ran into trouble with the Shu soldiers. And I've got a couple of flash bombs too. Kuei?"
"I have nothing," he said.
"You have that damn travel pack," said Jesper. "There's nothing useful in there?"
Kuei clutched the bag to his chest.
"My notebooks,"
he said with a sniff.
"What about the leavings from Weiland's work?" asked Matthias. No one had bothered to clear anything away.
"It's just some of the stuff he used to make the fireworks for Godmed Bridge," said Jesper.
A flurry of shouts came from outside.
"They're going to blow the door to the tomb," said Matthias.
It was what he would have done if he'd wanted prisoners instead of casualties, though he felt certain Kuei was the only one of them the Dime Lions cared about extracting alive.
"There have to be at least 30 toughs out there looking to skin our hides," said Jesper. "There's only one way out of the tomb, and we're on a damn island. We're done for."
"Maybe not," said Matthias, considering the ghostly green glow of the bone light.
Though he did not have Kaz's gift for scheming, he'd been raised in the military. There might be a way out of this.
"Are you crazy? The Dime Lions have to know how badly outnumbered we are."
"True," said Matthias. "But they don't know that two of us are Grisha."
They thought they were hunting a scientist, not an Inferni, and Jesper had long kept his fabricator powers a secret.
"Yeah, two Grisha with barely any training," said Jesper.
A loud boom sounded, shaking the tomb walls and sending Matthias careening into the others.
"They're coming!"
cried Kuei. But no footsteps sounded, and there was another series of shouts from outside.
"They didn't use a big enough charge," said Matthias. "They want you alive, so they're being cautious. We have one more chance. Kuei, how much heat can you produce from a flame?"
"I can make a fire burn more intensely, but it's hard to maintain."
Matthias remembered the violet flames licking over the body of the flying Shu soldier, inextinguishable. Weiland had said they burned hotter than ordinary fire.
"Give me one of the bombs," he told Jesper. "I'm going to blow the back of the catacomb."
"Why?"
"To make them think we're blasting our way out the other side," Matthias said, setting the bomb at the farthest end of the stone passage.
"Are you sure you aren't going to blow us up with it?"
"No," admitted Matthias, "but unless you have some brilliant idea." Shooting as many people as possible before we die is not an option."
Jesper shrugged.
"In that case, go on."
"Kuei, as soon as the bomb goes off, get to the front door as fast as you can. The gas should have diffused, but I want you to run. I'll be right behind you, lending cover. Do you know the tomb with the big broken mast?"
"To the right?"
"Yes. Head straight for that. Jesper, grab up all those powders that Weiland left and do the same."
"Why?"
Matthias lit the fuse.
"You can follow my orders or you can ask your questions of the Dime Lions. Now get down."
He shoved them both against the wall, shielding their bodies as a thunderous boom sounded from the end of the tunnel.
"Run!"
They burst through the catacomb door. Matthias kept a hand on Kuei's shoulder, urging him along as they raced through the remnants of the green gas.
Remember, head straight to the broken mast!
He kicked open the tomb door and lobbed a flash bomb into the air. It exploded in shards of diamond-white light, and Matthias ran for cover in the trees, blasting at the dime lions with his rifle as he dodged through the graves. The dime lions returned fire, and Matthias dove beneath a slump of moss-covered stones. He saw Jesper charge through the tomb door, revolvers blazing, cutting toward the broken stone mast. Matthias lobbed the last flash bomb into the air as Jesper rolled to the right, and the roar of gunfire erupted like a storm breaking as the dime lions forgot all promise of discipline or offer of reward and let fly with everything they had. They might have been ordered to keep Kuei alive, but they were barrel rats, not trained soldiers. On his belly, Matthias crawled through the dirt of the graveyard.
"Everyone unhurt?"
he asked as he reached the broken mast of the mausoleum.
"Out of breath but still breathing," said Jesper.
Kuei nodded, though he was shaking badly.
"Fantastic plan, by the way. How is being pinned down here better than being pinned down in the tomb?"
"Did you get Weiland's powders?"
"What was left of them," said Jesper.
He emptied his pockets, revealing three packets. Matthias chose one at random.
"Can you manipulate those powders?"
Jesper shifted uneasily.
"Yes, I guess. I did something similar at the ice court."
"Why?" "Why? Why?" In the Druskella he would have been brigged for insubordination.
"Black Vale is supposedly haunted, yes? We're going to make some ghosts."
Matthias glanced around the edge of the mausoleum.
"They're moving in. I need you to follow my orders and stop asking questions. Both of you."
"No wonder you and Kaz don't get along,"
Jesper muttered. In as few words as he could, Matthias explained what he intended now and when they reached the island shore, assuming his plan worked.
"I've never done this before," said Kuei.
Jesper winked at him. "That's what makes it exciting."
"Ready?"
said Matthias. He opened the packet. Jesper raised his hands, and with a light whump, the powder rose in a cloud. It hung suspended in the air as if time had slowed. Jesper focused, sweat beating on his forehead, then shoved his hands forward. The cloud thinned and rolled over the heads of the dime lions, then caught in one of their torches in a burst of green. The men surrounding the torch holder gasped.
"Kuei!"
directed Matthias. The shoe boy lifted his hands, and the flame from the green torch crept along the handle, snaking up the arm of its bearer in a sinuous coil of fire. The man screamed, tossing the torch away, falling to the ground and rolling in an attempt to extinguish the flames.
"Keep going,"
said Matthias, and Kuei flexed his fingers, but the green flames went out.
"I'm sorry,"
said Kuei.
"Make another,"
demanded Matthias. There was no time for cosseting. Kuei thrust his hands out again, and one of the dime lion's lanterns exploded, this time in a whirl of yellow flame. Kuei shrank back as if he hadn't intended to use so much force.
"Don't lose your focus,"
Matthias urged. Kuei curled his wrists, and the flames of the lantern rose in a serpentine arc.
"Hey," said Jesper, "not bad."
He opened another packet of powder and tossed its contents into the air, then arced his arms forward, sending it to meet Kuei's flame. The twisting thread of fire turned a deep, shimmering crimson.
"Strontium chloride,"
the sharpshooter murmured.
"My favorite."
Kuei flexed one of his fists, and another stream of fire joined the flames of the lantern, then another, forming a thick-bodied snake that undulated over Black Vale, ready to strike.
"Ghosts!"
one of the dime lions shouted.
"Don't be daft,"
replied another. Matthias watched that red serpent coil and uncoil in trails of flame, feeling the old fear rise in him. He'd grown comfortable with Kuei, and yet it had been Inferni fire that consumed his family's village in a border skirmish. Somehow, he'd forgotten the power this boy held within him. It was war, he reminded himself, and this is one too. The dime lions were distracted, but it wouldn't last long.
"Spread the fire to the trees," Matthias said,
and, with a little grunt, Kuei threw his arms wide. The green leaves fought the onslaught of devouring flame, then caught.
"They got a Grisha!" shouted Doughty. "Flank them!" "To the shore!" said Matthias. "Now!"
They sprinted past gravestones and broken stone saints.
"Kuei, get ready! We need everything you have!"
They skittered down the bank, tumbling into the shallows. Matthias grabbed the violet bombs and smashed them open on the hulls of the wrecked boats. Slithering violet flames engulfed them. It had an eerie, almost creamy quality. Matthias had navigated to and from Black Veil enough times to know this was the shallowest part of the canal, the long stretch of sandbar where boats were most likely to run aground, but the opposite shore seemed impossibly far away.
"Kuei!"
he commanded, praying that the shoe boy was strong enough, hoping that he could manage the plan Matthias had outlined bare moments earlier.
"Make a path!"
Kuei shoved his hands forward, and the flames poured into the water, sending up a massive plume of steam. At first, all Matthias could see was a wall of billowing white. Then the steam parted slightly, and he saw fish flopping in the mud, crabs skittering over the exposed bottom of the canal as violet flames licked at the water to either side.
"All the saints and the donkeys they rode in on," Jesper said on an awed breath.
"Kuei, you did it." Matthias turned back to the island and opened fire into the trees.
"Hurry!"
he shouted, and they ran over a road that had not been there moments before, bolting for the other side of the canal, for the streets and alleys that might lend them cover. "A natural," a voice clamored in his head. No, thought Matthias. Miraculous.
"You do realize you just led your own little Grisha army," said Jesper as they hauled themselves out of the mud and hurried through the shadowed streets toward Sweet Reef.
He had. An uncomfortable thought. Through Jesper and Kuei, he had wielded Grisha power, and yet Matthias did not feel tainted or somehow marked by it. He remembered what Nina had said about the construction of the ice court, that it must be the work of Grisha and not the work of Jell. What if both things were true? What if Jell worked through these people? Unnatural. The word had come so easily to him, a way to dismiss what he did not understand, to make Nina and her kind less than human. But what if behind the righteousness that drove the Druskala, there was something less clean or justified? What if it wasn't even fear or anger, but simply envy? What did it mean to aspire to serve Jell, only to see his power in the gifts of another? To know you could never possess those gifts yourself. The Druskala gave their oath to Fjarda, but to their god as well. If they could be made to see miracles where once they'd seen abomination, what else might change? "I have been made to protect you." His duty to his god. His duty to Nina. Maybe they were the same thing. What if Jell's hand had raised the waters the night of the wrathful storm that had wrecked the Druskala ship and bound Matthias and Nina together? Matthias was running through the streets of a foreign city into dangers he did not know, but for the first time since he'd looked into Nina's eyes and seen his own humanity reflected back at him, the war inside him quieted. "We'll find a way to change their minds," she'd said. "All of them." He would locate Nina. They would survive this night. They would free themselves of this damp, misbegotten city, and then, well, then they'd change the world.
20. Inej. Inej twisted, breaking the claw-like grip on the back of her neck. She scrambled to stop her fall. Her legs found purchase on the silo roof, and she yanked herself free, pushing away from the hatch. She rocked back on her heels, knives already released from their sheaths, deadly weight in her hands. Her mind could not quite make sense out of what she was seeing. A girl stood before her on the silo roof, gleaming like a figure carved of ivory and amber. Her tunic and trousers were the color of cream, banded in ivory leather and embroidered in gold. Her auburn hair hung in a thick braid laced with the glint of jewels. She was tall and slender. maybe a year or two older than Inej.
Inej's first thought was of the Caregood soldiers that Nina and the others had seen in West Stave. But this girl didn't look Shu.
"Hello, Wraith," the girl said.
"Do I know you?"
"I am Dunyasha, the White Blade, trained by the sages of Amrat Chen, the greatest assassin of this age."
"Doesn't ring a bell."
"I'm new to this city," the girl acknowledged. "But I'm told you are a legend on these filthy streets. I confess, I thought you'd be taller."
"What business?"
Inej asked. The traditional Kirch greeting at the beginning of any meeting, though it felt absurd to say it 20 stories in the air.
Dunyasha smiled.
It seemed practiced, like the smiles Inej had seen girls give customers in the gilded menagerie parlor.
"A crude greeting for a crude city."
She flicked her fingers carelessly toward the skyline, acknowledging and dismissing Ketterdam with a single gesture.
"Fate brought me here."
"And does fate pay your wages?"
Inej asked, sizing her up. She did not think this ivory and amber girl had scaled a silo just to make her acquaintance. In a fight, Dunyasha's height would give her a longer reach, but it might impact her balance. Had Vanek sent her? And if so, had he sent someone after Nina, too? She spared the briefest glance below but could see nothing in the deep shadows of the silos. "Who do you work for?" Knives appeared in Dunyasha's hands, their edges gleaming brightly.
"Our work is death," she said. "And it is holy."
An exultant light filled her eyes, the first true spark of life Inej had seen in her. And then she attacked. Inej was startled by the girl's speed. Dunyasha moved like painted light, as if she were a blade herself, cutting through the darkness, her knives slicing in tandem, left, right. Inej let her body respond, dodging more on instinct than anything else, backing away from her opponent but avoiding the silo's edge. She feinted left and slipped past Dunyasha, managing the first thrust of her own. Dunyasha whirled and evaded the attack easily, weightless as sun gilding the surface of a lake. Inej had never seen someone fight this way, as if she were moving to music only she could hear.
"Are you afraid, Wraith?"
Inej felt Dunyasha's knife shred through her sleeve. The sting of the blade was like a burning lash. "Not too deep," she told herself. Unless, of course, the blade was poisoned.
"I think you are. You cannot fear death and be its true emissary."
Was the girl mad? Or just chatty? Inej bobbed backward, moving in a circle around the silo's roof.
"I was born without fear,"
Dunyasha continued with a happy chuckle.
"My parents thought I would drown because I crawled into the sea as a baby, laughing.
Perhaps they worried you would talk yourself to death." Her opponent drove forward with new intensity, and Inej wondered if the girl had only been toying with her in that first aggressive flurry, feeling for her strengths and weaknesses before she seized the advantage. They exchanged thrusts, but Dunyasha was fresh. Inej could feel every ache and injury and trial of the last month in her body, the knife wound that had almost killed her, the trip up the incinerator, the days she'd spent bound in captivity.
"I confess to disappointment," Dunyasha said as her feet skipped nimbly over the silo's roof. "I had hoped you might prove a challenge, but what do I find? A smudge of a Suli acrobat who fights like a common street thug."
It was true. Inej had learned her technique from boys like Kaz and Jesper in the alleys and crooked streets of Ketterdam. Dunyasha didn't have just one mode of attack. She bent like a reed when required, stalked forward like a prowling cat, retreated like smoke. She had no single style that Inej could grasp or predict.
"She's better than me."
The knowledge had the taste of rot, as if Inej had bitten into a tempting fruit and found it foul. It wasn't just the difference in their training. Inej had learned to fight because she had to if she wanted to survive. She'd wept the night she'd made her first kill. This girl was enjoying herself. But Ketterdam had taught Inej well. If you couldn't beat the odds, you changed the game. Inej waited for her opponent to lunge, then leapt past her onto the wire stretched between the silos, moving recklessly across it. The wind reached out for her, eager now, sensing opportunity. She considered using the balance pole, but she wanted her hands free. She felt the wire wobble.
Impossible. But when she looked back over her shoulder, Dunyasha had followed her out onto the high wire. She was grinning, her white skin glowing as if she'd swallowed the moon. Dunyasha's hand shot out and Inej gasped as something sharp lodged in her calf.